Our next speaker is Steve Thompson. Steve has a BA in biology from Concordia College and an MS in geology from the University of North Dakota. He spent most of his career working for the state of Minnesota at the MPCA and the DNR. Prior to that, he worked as a geologist for Exxon and also worked for several years as a high school teacher. Steve retired from the DNR 2 years ago now, and we certainly miss him. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you, Ellen. I didn't expect to ever come back and give another talk here, but I'm not sure I should have accepted, but I did, and so here I am. Ellen made a very generous offer. She said I could be semi-honest, and of course, that's kind of a red flag for someone like me. But appreciate the talks. I think reflecting back on where we've been and where we're going is really important at this point of our life, particularly considering the political trends which we all know are flowing. And in some ways, it's all the more important that we design our systems and our policies and our work and our individual efforts to do everything we can to make a sustainable future. So that's kind of what we're talking about today. Deep state. Well, I couldn't have a talk about the deep state without mentioning President Trump. And the term deep state is coming up all the time. It's Stormy Daniels. Oliver North gets into the trend talking about deep state. And in that iteration, the deep state is a deep conspiracy of secret people who are doing work that the rest of us don't know about. Now, in my perspective, the deep state is really something actually much less ominous. It really is a ship of state. So those of us have worked through more than one administration, we are part of that ship of state. In fact, we are the deep state. We're the ones that keep things going. When there's administration changes in the local level, at governor level, or on the national level. So I think we should be proud of that. In fact, without having that continuation of institutions, of thoughts, of ideas, of programs, we're all going to be in much worse shape. And we won't survive going forward, and we'll suffer into a state similar to what they're going on in Somalia with no state at all. Now, what am I doing now that I've left the state? I'm a builder. I built my house while I was still working. That's inside and outside. I am renovating an immigrant log home, which I'm going to be turning into an inn. And on the inside of that, that's what the home looks like. Inside, you can actually see where the logs have been hewn to. So this is a hand-hewn immigrant log home from the 1860s. And in the basement, we are starting up a woodworking business. So some of the things that I've learned while I was at the state about how to set up programs is exactly what I'm doing as I'm setting up these businesses. So this is on one other thing we're doing, starting tomorrow, we're building a timber frame equipment barn. So that's one of my life after the PCA and DNR. The other thing I'm doing, spending a lot of time playing music. So is there anybody in the room with Swedish heritage in their background? Raise your hands. Okay. Did anybody, keep your hands up, anybody had go to Gustavus Adolphus College? Oh, there's a couple. If you did, you really should go to this concert because I play cello for the East Metro Symphony Orchestra. And we have an orchestra coming up, and it's going to be really an interesting one because there's a group of Swedish nickel harpa, which is a Swedish type of violin that you play with push buttons, and there will be 10 of them playing with the orchestra, so that's going to be really exciting. So mark that on your calendar. The last thing I'm doing is maple syruping. So we just this week finished up maple syruping, so maybe I'll be in the parking lot of the DNR PCR before too long and selling some maple syrup. So, where am I from? I'm from far northwestern Minnesota, so that's the context. By later in life, I got a degree in geology. And in geology, there's a really, two kind of opposite kind of organizing principles. There's a law of uniformitarianism, and there is punctuated equilibrium. So the first is changes happen over a long period of time. So you can look at the past and see what's happening, what you expect to happen in the future. Now, punctuated equilibrium is also a really important part in geologic development and evolution. It's big changes, like a meteor hitting the Earth. So in my life, and probably all of our life, we've had both of these experiences. Now, one of my formative experiences growing up was when I was I was in eighth grade. I was still not a very big kid, and I was actually a really, really bad basketball player. Didn't get the game very much at all. And we were playing in the neighboring school, McIntosh. And the only, crowd in the audience was just the high school boys, and they were watching the game. Got to the end of the game, and the coach said, "Is anybody on the bench here not score a basket all year?" Well, that would be me. So our sad sacks went into the game. And it got to the end of the game, and I found myself with the ball. And all of a sudden, I heard the audience counting down the time, 4, 3, 1, and I launched the ball. Well, it didn't hit the backboard. It hit the wall. And then the game kept going. What's going on? I realized then, to my humiliation, those high school players had played a trick on me. They counted down early so somebody would launch the ball. That was me. Well, that led me to a summer of baling hay, because somebody called me and said, "Bale some hay," got some exercise, went out for wrestling next year. And with that, it in many ways changed my life. The baling hay gave me the strength to be able to do good in wrestling and kind of take charge of things. I learned how to bale hay, which I'm still doing today. And, so those kind of things in your life, those seminal moments that shift you in a different direction, hopefully you can, you characterize those and take advantage of those. And in geology, my next seminal thing that really influenced my life in geology is the concept of geologic time. I spent about 3.5 years of my life really with my head in the Ordovician. This is kind of a depiction of that. And there's a lot of Ordovician terrain around us, and so that what's really interesting about it to me is a lot of abundant sea life, very little on land, so we had a lot of erosion coming in to our deposits. So that leads me to, I guess, to the topic of where we're going to today is what was my life at the state. I came to the pollution control agency in 1990. And Gretchen did a nice lead in. About that time, there was an explosion of work going on. Superfund had been in business for some period of time, had processes in place. When petroleum came, we tried to pretty much use the same type of process, investigations, cleanup standards, those kind of things. The problem was we were overwhelmed with the number of sites that we had. They didn't anticipate to have so many, but within the first couple of years, there were thousands of sites. Part of this was because there was a requirement that all tanks need to be upgraded. If they're upgraded, they're investigated. And we found that virtually all tanks had contamination, either from lines or from something in the problem. So they all leaked. Well, the problem was not only a huge number of a problem for the number that we had to deal with, but it was also hugely expensive, because we were pretty much digging up most of the contaminated soil at that time. We reached a point when we needed to make some change in how we're doing this, and we're making the changes on the fly, policy changes on the fly. And this brings us to a point of that we programs need to think about. What are we doing? What's the basis for doing it? What are the assumptions that we are operating on? Now, one of the things that we found that most of these petroleum plumes weren't very big. Most of them, by the time we found them, they had stopped expanding. They're about 200 feet in length. And most of the things that we did to clean them up transfer the contamination to the air. So that led us to a risk-based approach, which pretty much the whole country had to go to. The sooner they went to it, the less money they wasted, essentially. So the decision was made it was a really difficult philosophical time in the program. In fact, there was a point when we had to call in counselors from the outside to help mediate the differences in which way we should go. Should we clean it all up, or do we take a risk-based approach? And I think, you know, we went with a risk-based approach with the understanding that we would be, with the idea that we would have put institutional controls in place. Now, that's one of the questions that is ongoing as we have databases that people to identify, you know, what the contaminant levels are in at all these sites. There's no reason now that we shouldn't have plume maps so we can have a full understanding of where these contamination plumes are. So if the people are in their program, I think that's one of the charges is to look at and finish that part of the program. One of the other things which I just wanted to mention briefly that made a big influence in the way I looked at the programs that we worked on was the book The Selfish Gene. One of the most important science books that was written or characterized as. The Selfish Gene talks about the gene-centered view of evolution as opposed to, it never made sense to me that when Darwin said, you know, species, you know, want to compete for existence. It seems to be, you know, empirically true, but how does a species do that? What Dawkins answered the question is it's not the species, it's the gene, and carrying on a part of that gene, which is what makes the, you know, the whole thing work. He threw in another part at the end of his book called memes, and that's a concept of cultural evolution. And analogous to genes, memes are a selfish way of replication of how we evolve human culture. And what struck me at the time when it kind of changed the way I looked at things, if memes have all the characteristics of genes, and that is of species, they have the kind of the same organizing principles. They want to continue to exist in their niche and expand in their niche. And if humans have done this in our memes, our external genes, in evolving all of these external genes, well, we have a problem here because there is no sustainability in continued growth. So all of our external concepts, our means, our government, religion, any organization that you have, the underlying premise is to continue to expand. Now, the problem with humans is we've expanded beyond all the niches and we're kind of suffocating ourselves. So in a way, sustainability is an alien function, is an alien concept to the concept of evolution. So that is why it's so difficult, it's so important that we have systems in place that can understand what we're doing and explain what was going on with climate change and other degradation issues to the public. When I was given a new assignment, took an assignment to develop programs, the Ambient Groundwater Network and the Load Monitoring Network, I thought about genes when we're designing this up. What you want is sustainable systems. In terms of the ambient groundwater system, as Gretchen has said, it had gone away because of budget cuts people didn't feel as important. So when you're setting up programs, think about all of the components that go into it. It has to be efficient. It has to be have a good reason for existence. It has to have a good grounding in philosophical, and it has to produce something that's of real value. Now, I know that's true with the ambient program because it continues to exist, and it's grown to the point where it's really valuable in showing what's going on with the background information around the state. The other program that we developed started at the same time as restarting the ambient program was the Watershed Pollutant Load Monitoring Network. It's the same concept. When we designed it, we wanted a self-sustaining program that has a purpose for existence that is tied into other ecosystems of other programs and will continue to exist in space and time. This is an issue I think that all organizations need to address, and it has to do with, well, bureaucratic rot. In any organization, eventually you're going to have a second or third rate manager. And that second or third rate manager probably will hire us second or third rate people. Eventually you have programs that can be filled with low quality people. And then the good people leave. So this happens in every organization, whether it's business, government, you know, religious or whatever it is. In businesses, it's a little easier because there's a bottom line. You know, at one point, if the profits go down, they're going to find what the corporate is, and they're going to take care of it. In government, we need to develop those systems of accountability. They're there, they're available for us, but we need to take advantage of it. So, successful programs. We need to have clear messages and purposes. We need to have data and science-based decision-making, because that if we're waving our arms in the air, you know, we don't have that rock standard to go by. So we need to get these systems in place. We need accountability systems. So not only for management going up for staff, but also for the programs. Do they have a reason for existence as they once did, or did they never? A great example is the air emissions program that went on for some time at the PCA. I don't know if you remember this, but we used to drive our car in. They'd put your sensor under the car, tell you you're good. It was an excellent program. It got lots of rave reviews from magazines. The problem was over 95, 98% of cars passed the test. So the program was well run, but it really didn't have a reason to exist anymore because of, well, because they changed cars and now we had emission controls that were made obsolete. But because of the nature of memes, programs will continue to exist unless something shuts them down. So memes will continue to exist, programs will continue to exist until, you know, somebody actually looks at what is the purpose of these things. So finishing up, accountability, we should really have 360-degree evaluations, well, up and down, and they should be taken into account with hiring, with promotions, those kind of things. When I worked for Exxon, there was forced ranking. So if you have to do it that way, you find ways to find where your good employees are. 3M went through this some number of years ago where they shifted from, you know, basically people had lifetime jobs to standards. And, you know, I think that may be the way we have to go. Other thing you can do is have outside audits of programs. I think this could be, you know, ways, are you doing what we want you to do? And are there, you know, are there other things that we should be doing, or should we make changes? And creativity and innovation, you know. There was a study done some time ago about a bell-shaped curve of people's ability to embrace change or resist change. Not surprisingly, government workers are shifted towards resistance to change. So the change agents in government systems are often kind of outliers, but we need to listen to them. And last thing, transparency. We have to be open to what we're doing. We should be proud of what we're doing and open about it. So, you know, I think that'll, as we gain the trust and integrity of the public, as we maintain it, I think this is something we need to do. And just a final word, what we do is so important, and what you all do is so important. I applaud you for the work you do. I'm kind of on the outside now looking back in. I'm proud of the work that I did as I work for the state, and continue to strive forward to the things that will make us a more sustainable environmental community. Thank you.